Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
It's just over a month since the election, and in Connecticut, Democrats made gains across the state. But in Stonington and North Stonington, a surprise as the incumbent was ousted by Republican newcomer Greg Howard. Plus, a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. It's just over a month now since the elections, and while we still wait for the very final results of the presidential race and some Senate races in January yet to come, the situation here in Connecticut is much clearer. The Democrats in the state managed to increase their position with some wins, but there were also some losses too. In the 43rd District of Stonington and North Stonington in southeastern Connecticut, incumbent State Representative Kate Rotella lost to Republican challenger and newcomer Greg Howard. The win came as a surprise and upset to the Democrats. So just who is Greg Howard, and how will he represent his constituents when the new legislative session starts in January of 2021? I spoke to him recently via Zoom to find out more. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Brian. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So you won the seat from the incumbent, Kate Rotella, in the recent elections by about 300 votes, I believe. Tell us a little bit about yourself, but also why did you want to get involved in local politics?
Well, thank you very much. Real quick history about me. The 43rd District is Stonington and North Stonington, and the east side of Stonington is Pawcatuck, and it's very much one community with Westerly, Rhode Island, separated by a river. It's two states, but two towns, and very much one community. And I grew up in Westerly. My mom was from Pawcatuck, my dad from Westerly, and my grandparents were still living in Pawcatuck, and I spent a lot of time there growing up. And in 2002, became a police officer in Stonington and bought my first home in Pawcatuck in 2003. So I've been a Stonington resident for 17 years. Currently, I live in Pawcatuck still with my wife of 12 years, Shayna. We have two boys, 11 and 9, both attending public school. And outside of, you know, police work, which I've been doing again for my 19th year now, done patrol, I've been a canine handler. And most recently, the last 5 years, I've been a detective. Outside that, one of the things that I'm very proud of is the youth football program that I run in town. A few years ago, we made that a play-for-free football program to make sure that all kids could be included in. Shana and I, with some help of some other parents, work really hard with donations and running the league in a very fiscally conservative way to make sure that we can achieve that play-for-free status so the kids can play for free. And, of course, I coach as well. Both of my boys play football, a very important sport. And how I got into politics was really, you know, not by intent, not even really by on purpose. I'd been approached for years from friends and family who said, you know, you should really run for something after police work and et cetera. And it's, you know, I heard it, didn't think about it very often, and just continued in my service and the things that I was doing. And this winter, I was approached by some Republicans and asked to run for the state rep spot. And I said, well, no thanks. I just don't think the time is correct. And, you know, when you talk about the election and winning by, you know, just under 300 votes, which was like a 0.9% margin, it's a Democratic controlled district, you know, the two towns, not so much North Stonington, but Stonington, where more of the votes are, is heavily Democratic. And when you're a challenger and a political newcomer district like that, you know, the campaign takes a lot of work. And, you know, September, October are the heart of my football season. So when COVID happened and my football season got canceled, that opened up the time and the ability to do it. And then, you know, the police bill had passed, and that was really, more people are encouraging me, hey, you're the type of guy who can communicate and talk with people and get people to understand things and come up with solutions. I really think you should consider a run. And a lot of things were taking place in late July, early August, when my wife and I had talked, and we're faithful people. And my wife had said to me at one point in time, one evening, she said, you know, how many more signs do you need that, you know, this is the time for you to do this? You know, your community needs you, and, you know, you always follow your heart and follow what, you know, God's choice is for you. And what I didn't tell you was about a year and a half ago, I started working with Oz Griebel, who was a third party gubernatorial candidate in 2018, who obviously did not win. He and I have been working together on some, you know, nonpartisan slash bipartisan stuff. And he was a great guy, former Republican, but he became unaffiliated. And my wife said that to me that night, how many more signs do you need? Well, I woke up in the morning and saw that Oz had passed away in a tragic accident in Pennsylvania. So again, being a faithful person, and she's saying, how many more signs do you need? And I see that. I said, well, maybe it is time. And so I petitioned or got the petitions to get onto the candidate as an unaffiliated petitioning candidate, at which point the Republican nominee, who I'm very good friends with, and who's a super guy, class act, basically came to me and said, you know, I think you're a great candidate. And if you are willing to run, then we're going to endorse you, and I'm going to withdraw. And so I ended up with the Republican and independent nominations for the spot, and got on the ballot in both lines, was victorious by a slim margin.
Let me put this to you. As you've said, you are a long-serving police officer, and that is a very high-stress job. You gave yourself literally about 3 months to get your campaign, you know, before, obviously, election. What on earth were you thinking?
Well, you know, again, it was, and a lot of people said that to me. You know, some people asked me, hey, if you knew you were going to do this, well, if I knew I was going to do this, I would have done it a lot sooner. I put myself in, you know, not exactly the greatest position here by doing this at the last minute. But I was confident in my work ethic. I was confident in my support system, both at home and my family, coworkers, and, you know, a group of close friends. And, you know, those are conversations that were had, and I knew they were going to be there, and I knew we could all work together. And that's what we did. We hit the ground running. You know, there's the Citizens Election Program grant. We were registered for that on whatever was the first Friday in August. The 6th or something like that. I look at a calendar, but we registered for that. And in the course of a weekend, we're able to put together, I think, 267 donations and $6,000 to qualify for the grant in a single weekend, or, you know, by Monday. So, you know, that's just the sort of work ethic that this campaign, not just me, but a lot of people brought to the table. And that sort of work ethic and that commitment to it continued through August, September, and October, and right through Election Day.
Before we move on to asking you a few more questions about obviously your position on various things, I just want to put this question to you. When you knew you had won, and like we said, it was a fairly slim margin of about 300 votes, but nevertheless, it's 300 votes. What were your thoughts?
Well, we were sitting at my brother-in-law, who's up in North Stonington. He's got a garage and, you know, a couple of close family members. You know, because of COVID, we couldn't have your normal sort of campaign party. So my closest family members and friends were there, and we were watching the numbers come in on my cell phone, and we actually had all of the Stonington numbers first. And so we were down by about 400 and knew we needed to win North Stonington by, you know, a slightly larger margin than that. So when we saw the numbers come in, we were 700 and some up. It was a mixed emotion. It was exciting, you know, because, you know, I am a competitor by nature. Political race is a competition of sorts. So the victory, so to speak, was exciting, but it was also a wave of other emotion, because all of the hard work that had been put in by everybody in that room sort of came to a culmination of, we did it right. And it settled in then that, you know, you got the responsibility. You have to do things right for the people. And it's something that, as a police officer, I've taken seriously for a long time. Police work has never been a job to me. It's been a calling. It's been a part of my life. It's not, you know, a job where I get up and I go to work and I come home and then I don't think about it again until the next morning. Being a police officer is something that you are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Any police officer spouse will tell you that they don't just leave that at the office. It doesn't work like that. Your personal life and your police life intertwine. And, you know, this new position is the same thing. So, you know, that sort of wave of emotion of, you know, taking that next step and being able to do even more for people than I had been doing was very emotional. And you know, my kids were there. There's a great screenshot. Somebody took a still shot of them, you know, jumping up right in my arms. My wife standing next to her clapping with a big smile. And it sort of was a great moment in time, a great capture of what things are like. It's, you know, everybody kind of gets together and everybody's happy for each other in this campaign and this group of people that will continue to work together. It's just my name on the sign, but this was an effort that was, you know, really grassroots in this community. So I'm super proud of that.
You've got a lot to learn, as it were, from a political standpoint. Obviously, as you say, you are very community driven. So you've spoken to the community, you know, some of the things that the community, are interested in and want looked at, obviously, as, you know, their representative at the legislature. The new session starts in January, so that's not too far off. Let's talk about some of your positions. I mean, as a police officer, one of the things that you did mention in your campaign is the controversial and recently signed into law Police Accountability Bill. What's your beef with that?
Well, I think the biggest trouble that I have with that police bill is that the way that it was rushed through and didn't have enough expert input. And what I mean is, when you are not a police officer, you have an idea of what police do from watching TV or maybe one or two police encounters or however many encounters you may have had. But there's a lot of aspects to everything that we do. And there's a lot of things that people don't realize, don't know, don't think about. And when you look at that police bill, I don't think for one second that it was anything but well-intended. I think that the intent there was to make sure that we don't have a police department or a police force in the state of Connecticut that is out of control, unchecked, not transparent, or unaccountable. I think that was the goal of that bill, was well-intended. But when you don't get enough input from not just one or two police officers, but policing in general has several aspects to it. So if you've been, say, a traffic officer your entire life, and you've never done narcotics investigations or sexual assault investigations or homicide investigations, and there's aspects of policing that you just don't know. And it's important that when you put laws in that restrict officers' ability to do things, that you get input from all those different departments within the departments or divisions within the departments to make sure that we're not crippling the police officers' ability to do their job and do their job well. And what I mean is, for example, there, you know, one section of that police bill says that you cannot do a search of a person even with their consent, unless you have probable cause. And probable cause, loosely translated, is facts and circumstances that lead a reasonable person to believe certain evidence is contained in a certain place when you're talking about searches. So when you have a burglary victim, for example, somebody comes home and you burglarize their home and you get a DNA swab off the doorknob, well, you need to get what we call exemplar DNA. Because when you send that DNA swab to the lab, they want to know who are the homeowners and the people that live there that it could be their DNA for exclusionary purposes. But when you ask the victim for consent to get their DNA and you're sticking a swab inside their cheek, it's a search of their person. There's no probable cause that they have evidence of a crime within their cheek. It's exemplary, but the new law says that you can't do that. And that's a problem. And, you know, it's a similar thing in narcotics investigations. And the state's attorney's office will tell you that, well, it's okay because the suspect in the case doesn't have the standing to contest the search of the victim, which is true, except that if the victim gets upset with you at some point and sues you for a bad search, the words on the paper say you can't do what you did. So it's problematic. And those are the types of things, you know, consent searches of motor vehicles and so on down the line, where there wasn't enough input from the people who do the job every day to say, well, I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to make sure that we don't have police officers out there that are getting consent, you know, not in the right manner, or maybe even not getting consent, or only ask for consent from a certain group of people. That was the goal. But the collateral damage was you've just interrupted a lot of sex assault investigations, for example, for DNA, burglary investigations, robbery investigations, all these felony crimes that are now problematic for us to do because of this new law they put in without a lot of forethought.
I think everybody can agree that, you know, the law did appear to be pushed through in a hurry, and it is our understanding that it will be revisited in the new legislative session, as it should be. So obviously there is discussion ahead on that. I want to put this point to you just very quickly, though, because I do want to talk about some other issues with you. Bearing in mind the mood of the nation earlier this year because of events that happened that involved police, the Black community, were you not concerned about using this as one of your campaign points?
No, not really, because you may not have seen this, Brian, back in the end of May, beginning of June, there were several rallies in downtown Mystic, which is, you know, the west end of my district now, that were speaking for Black Lives Matter, against police brutality, et cetera. And I had approached my police chief at the time, or, you know, still my chief, but at that time went and said, hey, chief, you know, I think you know, we should go down to these rallies and stand with these people from our community who are calling attention to this injustice that happened in Minneapolis, which is what they were doing. This was all a reaction to the George Floyd thing, and rightfully so. I watched the same video. I had the same concerns they did. And so my concern at the time I brought to the chief was, if somebody from Stonington Police doesn't go down there and let these folks know that we agree that what we saw was wrong, that those that officer should be held accountable, and the ones who did nothing and stood by should be held accountable. If we don't stand with them, the result is that the police are the police are the police. So these protesters are going to naturally lump us in with that, having not heard from us. And we're going to have problems in Stonington that we didn't have or wouldn't have had if we had had some sort of sense of unity with them. So he said, I agree. You're go ahead and do that. So that's what I spent 3 days down there with those protesters. I think there was a picture that appeared in the paper with me holding a sign that said Black Lives Matter. And, you know, that's an important thing to talk about too, that the slogan Black Lives Matter and the organization Black Lives Matter, you know, we need to differentiate between the two. So, you know, there's aspects of the organization's mission that I don't agree with, but, you know, just in general, that the life of a Black person is important. And that we need to call attention to certain places in our country and certain people to let them know that Black lives are as important as white lives. Because when you look at a case like George Floyd, you can see while Black people can feel that their lives aren't as important in the eyes of certain people, i.e. Derek Chauvin. So we went down and did that. So when you take that into context of me coming out as a police officer and saying, you know, I think this police bill can be revamped and being able to have those good conversations about why, like we just did. And, you know, people knowing, hey, this is a guy who stood with Black Lives Matter protesters to stand against racism. He is, you know, supports that aspect of it too. That was my opportunity, I think, to sit here and say, hey, I know police work. I know the concerns of the other side. And I think that there's a place that we can land to ensure police accountability without eviscerating the officers, law enforcement's ability to keep us all safe in our neighborhoods in an honorable and respectful way. So I didn't have overly concerns about it. And frankly, I didn't along the campaign trail meet anybody who said that, you know, well, you know, if you're speaking against a police bill, you're a racist or any of that. Fortunately, it's a small community and they know me better. So that didn't really become an issue.
Let's talk about the economy. Of course, all of us are, you know, being hit hard by COVID-19 and the effects it is having on the economy. What are some of the problems that you foresee going forward?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of problems. You know, we're looking at a second surge now, another possible shutdown. And I think that there again, what we lack in politics or in our culture and society now is a semblance of balance. So, you know, the police bill, for example, it's either the police are terrible or they're great. Or, you know, you can't come in the middle and say, okay, we need a Czech police force that's empowered to do their job. You know, you can't find that middle ground. And I would say that about COVID too. You know, I think we've, in the last, you know, 8 months, realized that while COVID is a danger, it is a virus, it is a real virus. Anybody who says it's not is, you know, fooling themselves. It's a real virus and it does have, you know, lethal consequences for some people. But at the same time, I think we need to take a look at, you know, our economy. We cannot cripple our economy because our economy, most of our world revolve around that. Unfortunate as it may be, that's sort of how it is. And I also talk about children's mental health. I had sent a letter to the governor back in May, long before I made a decision to run for office, and expressed to him my concern over, you know, youth sports being shut down and kids being sequestered and put into isolation and the effect that I was watching it have on kids in my football program and, you know, sons, friends of my son. So I think that there's a balance there. And I think from a business standpoint, we have to support our businesses. I think Governor Lamont did some really innovative and great things to try to find that balance by, you know, I use as an example, telling Connecticut bars that you can serve alcohol in your parking lot. You can put tables and chairs outside without a special permit, just, you know, by executive order to do these things so that you can keep your business going in a safe manner. And I think that those sort of innovative ideas and, you know, working together between, you know, business owners and, you know, legislative health district and those types of organizations to say, what can we do to keep our economy going in a safe and healthy way? And that's, you know, what I think we should continue to work towards, you know, until we can get past this pandemic, which I hope is very soon.
One of the other things that was mentioned in your campaign is about fighting for local control. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is What happens is, so Connecticut's not exactly a large state in comparison to other states, but it is a large state and it's a diverse state, and the municipalities differ from one place to the next. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons. You know, there has been a push for regionalization, you know, sort of a standard state for zoning. And, you know, I'm not in favor of that. I think that individual communities and individual towns know their town. They know what they want for their town. They all have their own plan of development conservation. And so to let those towns keep control over those things and not have it come from Hartford. And I think one of the biggest places for that is education, because what you see is mandates from Hartford coming out on municipalities that certain municipalities don't necessarily need that mandate. It's not helpful. It's costly. So now this, the Board of Education budget is being, you know, impacted. So something else is going to get cut to replace it with something that we didn't necessarily need in that particular municipality. And what that's what I'm talking about is to allow municipalities to know their community, let their own Board of Finance, their own mayor, their own Board of Education, or, you know, school committee, or however they're set up, make the decisions that are best for their community, as opposed to Hartford doing a one size fits all, because it just doesn't work like that. You know, each community is different. Each community faces its own, has its own strengths, its own weaknesses, its own pros and cons. And they need to be allowed to make their own decisions for their community, what they think is best, because they know it best. And that's sort of what I mean by that.
You're a Republican candidate. You unseated the Democrat incumbent, but of course the Democrats did strengthen their position generally across the state. How much of a challenge do you see that being when you actually do go to the legislature, that the Republicans, you know, won't have as much power? So how do you feel about that?
Well, Brian, I think that, you know, more and more, you know, I talk to Democrats and I think to them, geez, you're kind of like a Republican. And Republican or Democrats talk to me and say, are you sure you're Republican? And I, you know, we joke about it in these conversations. But I think the reality is, you know, the election is over. You know, we should be done with the politics part and working on the government part. And there's 151 of us in the House, and Republican, Democrat, wherever you're from, we should all be working for what's best for our particular districts and the best for the state of Connecticut. And I have had some conversations with, you know, what will be Democratic colleagues. I have had conversations with what will be Republican colleagues. And I think that there is a lot of common ground. And I think that if we can get together and have, you know, open communication and work on common ground issues. So what I mean is, you know, I think everybody in Hartford wants our economy to be better. Nobody wants Connecticut to be the lowest ranking in every financial analysis that seems to come out. So the question is, how do we get there? And I think if we get to the table together and both come up with ideas, or all come up with ideas and throw them out there with all of our different backgrounds, we can really get things done. And to me, I don't see it as Republican Democrat anymore. I know that there are probably Republicans who won't talk to a Democrat simply because of that. I'm sure there are Democrats who won't talk to Republicans, but what I'll do is go up there and have as many conversations as I can with whomever I can, to do what's best for the people of the 43rd district and ultimately the best for people in Connecticut. And I think if we can sort of start to bridge those gaps and say, hey, we agree on more than we disagree on, we can really start moving in the right direction. I think that the Republicans in Hartford, me included, are in a position where we need to do that now. We need to, you know, meet with our Democratic colleagues and say, you know, you have the majority, and that's understood, but we need to work together, and we're willing to come to the table to work together. Because if we don't, we're not going to get a lot done, I think, which to your point.
How are you going to balance all of this with your continued career in the police?
That's a good question. So a lot of people ask me that. I think my wife probably put that best. And she jumped in and answered and said, hey, I know him best. And I'm by him every single day. And I will tell you how he'll do it. He just gets things done. That's just how he is. For me, I'm fortunate in my position at the police department where I have two other detectives that I work with who are supportive, and, you know, we can work out to make sure that if I'm going to be in Hartford, one of them is here to respond to major incidents. And as far as the schedule itself, it's very flexible for me. So it's not uncommon for me to work a Sunday and take a Tuesday off. If I have to go to Hartford for a 4-hour meeting, I could come in the morning, go to Hartford, do my meeting, come back in the evening. And in a lot of ways, the two cross paths as far as, you know, what you're doing, you're serving the community. And you know, being at events and being publicly available to constituents here in the 43rd is something I was already doing. So that's not a major change.
Greg Howard, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations, of course, on your win as the new Republican representative for the 43rd District of Stonington and North Stonington. We look forward to having many more conversations with you in the future. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Ryan, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, the first selectman of East Lyme, Mark Nickerson, has announced he will not run for another term next November and will leave the office after finishing his seventh year. Nickerson, who has served 6 years as first selectman of East Lyme after being appointed to the position to replace Paul Formica after he was elected to the state senate in 2014, announced his decision in a letter included in the Friday, November 27th edition of the monthly East Lyme Parks and Recreation publication, Events Magazine. In the day this week, Tony Shea, the 46-year-old founder of the online shoe retailer Zappos, died from complications of smoke inhalation. The Connecticut Office of the Chief Medical Examiner reported, ruling his death as accidental. Shea was injured in an early morning fire on November 18th at a home at 500 Pequod Avenue in New London and died on Friday the 20th. His death was reported by DTP Companies, which he founded. An audio recording of the exchange between the city's emergency dispatchers, firefighters, and police revealed that initial reports from the scene were of a fire and a man who had either barricaded himself inside or was trapped in the waterfront home. Firefighters arrived at the home to find individuals outside and Shea still inside. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, officials urge Norwich residents to use Access Health CT and get insured. State and local officials gathered in Norwich to urge people who need insurance to sign up for Access Health CT, which is the state insurance marketplace created in 2011. The need for insurance in Norwich comes from the current state of employment in the city. As of October, Norwich had the fourth highest unemployment rate at around 9.6%. In the Middletown Press this week, one of the few remaining tea shops in Connecticut, where customers enjoy the ancient ritual of tea time, complete with homemade scones, tiny sandwiches, delicate bone china, and hand-blended loose-leaf tea, will be closing its doors at the end of the month and shifting to an online marketplace. Peggy Kamoski, owner of Tea Roses Tea Room in Cromwell, has been in business for 11 years. She closed in April due to the pandemic, then shifted to takeout, in which customers could select baskets full of their favorite items. She will be closing up shop on December 23rd. In the Chronicle this week, another small elementary school has temporarily closed to COVID-19 while one in neighbouring Chaplin plans to reopen. Scotland Elementary School would be closed for 2 weeks due to a confirmed case of the coronavirus within the school's population. The school building closed on Monday, 30th of November, and according to the school's website, the district will be going to distance learning as of Tuesday, December 1st. And in next week's Connecticut East This Week, the Connecticut Port Authority has been mired in scandal for the past few years and has also been the subject of criticism from private citizens and more recently professional organizations. In a Connecticut East This Week exclusive, we sit down with John Henshaw, the new executive director of the Port Authority, to talk about his role as well as the challenges he faces in turning around the image and fortunes of the CPA, especially around the controversial State Pier project in New London. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.